9 daughters in Devahuti, and how all the daughters were later handed over to great sages like Marichi, Atri, and Vasistha. Text 13. Patni Marichis Tukala Shushuvikarda Maja Kasyapam Purnimanam Cha Yayura Puritam Jagad. Kardamuni's daughter Kala, who was married to Marichi, gave birth to 2 children, whose names were Kasyapa and Purnima. Their descendants are spread all over the world. Purnima Sutavirajam Visvagam Saparantapa Devakulyam Haripada Suchadya Butsaridviva. My dear Vidura, of the 2 sons, Kasyapa and Purnima, Purnima begot 3 children, namely Viraja, Visvasa, and Devakulya. Of these 3, Devakulya was the water which washed the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, and which was later on transformed into the Ganges of the heavenly planets. And there's a purport. Sounds interesting, this Devakulya. Purport. Of the 2 sons, Kasyapa and Purnima, herein Purnima's descendants are described. An elaborate description of these descendants will be given in the 6th canto. It is also understood herein that Devakulya is the presiding deity of the river Ganges, which comes down from the heavenly planets to this planet and is accepted to be sanctified because it's touched the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari. Om Agyanatimarandasya Kinandana Salakaya Chakshuraminitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swaparantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yudhapada Kamalam Shri Gurun Vaisnavamstya Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vidantam Sajivam Sadvitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sivisakam Vidamstya. So here we find a further description of the dynasty coming down through from Manu, and how Manu, the forefather of mankind, actually how mankind gradually came about through Manu. It is explained that through Kardama Muni and Devahuti, through Daksha, and like that there are many means through which the universe is being populated. When we come to this particular verse with the purport, which describes that Devakulya was the water which washed the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, and which later transformed into the Ganges of the heavenly planets. It's amazing, right? It's amazing how the spiritual world works, right? That the water is a personality, and that he can later, he was the water that washed the feet of the Lord, and he's a personality at the same time. So how to understand that remains mystical to us, right? It remains something where we have to stretch our imagination how such a thing is possible. We cannot possibly fully picture this. What happened? Was Devakulya a human being, and then whoop, suddenly he became water, washed the feet of the Lord, then he was human being again, and then he was later Ganges again, like that. And what about Ganga Devi, who is riding on a crocodile? Isn't Ganga Devi the deity of the river Ganges, right? It's well known that Ganga Devi, a female form, is riding on a crocodile, which is representing that the Ganges is flowing right across the material energy, which is like the crocodile. The material energy represented by the crocodile, and Ganga riding all throughout the material world, and yet being unaffected. So in this way, Ganga Devi is riding on her crocodile. Here we're seeing Devakulya. So these matters may remain a little ambiguous, a little bit vague. They just make us aware how amazing transcendental knowledge is. Transcendental knowledge is coming to us in the descending process. And knowledge that is coming to us in the descending process is distinctly different from the ascending process. Because knowledge in the ascending process, which is the process of modern science, is a system where one very slowly and systematically tries to work upwards or outwards from one is situated in ignorance, tries to expand his area of knowledge very systematically and just increase our area of knowledge. But this ultimately, it seems that it's very thorough. Right? It seems to, this ascending process appears to be very thorough and to really try to go to the heart of the matter. But then it never goes to the heart of the matter because it's just, there's more and more and there's more and more complexities. Now, in this way, through the ascending process, one starts off with ignorance, then gradually one collects a lot of information and one thinks one knows a lot, and then over time it becomes more and more complex and there's more and more to know, and one realizes that actually we still don't know anything. We don't know anything at all. Like about the universe, right? For example, the model of the universe. So much is known now, right? Positions of planets, etc. So many things are known, orbits, still, we don't know anything, right, about the universe. It's in that way. The descending process gives us a lot of information about many things and many dimensions. It immediately establishes that there's not only one universe, but that there are unlimited universes. It immediately gives us a full description of the positions of the different planets within the universe and so on, and of the living beings residing there, and what the purpose is of their existence, and what their karma is, and so on. We can understand many things from Vedic literatures. But then, through the descending process, coming down from the Supreme Lord through the cyclic succession. But then, in the end, there are also details that remain unclear. Right? So, this is not an imperfection in Krishna consciousness. The fact that every detail is not perfectly clear doesn't mean that that there are faults in the philosophy of Krishna consciousness and that it's incomplete. Right? The point is this, is that it is simply impossible. It is said that anupalakshya vartmane, this path is the inconceivable way of the Lord. Right? Anupalakshya vartmane, the inconceivable way of the Lord. So it's a given that there will be so much unknown, so much not understood of how things work and the mechanics of how the Lord is arranging both the material and the spiritual energy remains somewhere along the line inconceivable. So here we are coming to a partially inconceivable aspect, or at least unclear. Who is this Devakulya? How exactly did he wash the feet of the Lord, right? Devakulya was the water which washed the feet of the personality of Godhead, right? And later became the Ganges. It's some sort of like difficult to figure out. So we accept. We simply accept. So there are things which we just accept without further explanation. I don't think that there would be many devotees who would have read in other scriptures more about Devakulya, right? And in fact, if you would ask someone who is Devakulya, that most would not score very well on that question, right? Because We have limited memories, and although we've read the fourth canto, if I would ask anybody in which canto is Devakulya being discussed, I would be surprised if anyone would get it right, right? Unless he just read it yesterday. Right? Then it's another matter. So there are such details in Srimad Bhagavatam which you just accept. Okay, Devakulya was the water that washed the feet of the Lord, and he later became the Ganga. He's the presiding deity of the Ganga, although there's also a Ganga Devi who is also the presiding deity of the Ganga. Did Devakulya change sex? Did he become Ganga Devi later on? No, I don't think so. He's a man. He's a man. Yeah, he's a son. He's a man. Well, what we understand here. But maybe not, yeah. Anyway, so what can we say? So whatever the some details, we rather accept for understanding a principle rather than understanding a detail. Sometimes we make too much of a detail, and actually the essence is the principle. And the principle is simply that there are these dynasties which are all part of the plan of the Supreme Lord. When Lord Brahma creates the universe, he does so according to a blueprint which is provided to him through mystic power by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this is part of executing that plan. And that within that plan there are these family lineages of great saintly personalities. And sometimes the Lord appears in their dynasties, and other great personalities appear in their dynasties, and they are like very, very influential. Like Priyavrata had that chariot which was so powerful and that it could replace the sun. And just like the sun god has a chariot, Priyavrata decided that he didn't like night nor winter. So he didn't have much liking for winter, so therefore Priyavrata followed the orbit of the sun with his own chariot and arranged that it was never dark, and also arranged that there was no winter and that the sun was always shining. And it is said that in the course of driving around with his chariot, Priyavrata cut the landmass into seven pieces and created in this way the seven principal continents. Now, go tell that to some scientist. Or yesterday we read a little bit in the conversations with Srila Prabhupada, and then in 1977 there was a lot of talk about this deprogramming, because it was really going on at that time in America. There was a court case about brainwashing and all these things, and this was exactly the kind of things these people would read in the court, Hare Krishna's believe, and then, do you really believe, that Priyavrata was riding with a chariot through the sky and like replacing the sun, and that the wheels of his chariot cut the landmass into seven pieces, and that's how the continents were formed? Do you really believe that? Right. So then, then on the strength of that, they would say that they were mentally, right, in an unhealthy condition, and therefore had to be placed under some authority in this, that, and therefore, could not be responsible for their own actions. And they tried to get these kind of court orders, right? So they were very tricky about that. So do we really believe? Yes, we really believe. But how it really, on the strength of Bhagavatam? And Prabhupada's answer was like, at one point then the discussion came from the moon. So do you really believe they didn't go to the moon, right? And then there was a whole argument. And Prabhupada said he said, you have to understand is that we didn't go to the moon. We weren't with them when they went. So how do we know? You didn't go to the moon either. So how do you know? You only know it from a piece of paper. You read the paper. Right? You read the paper And in the paper you read that they went to the moon. They said, and we are also reading paper. We're just reading other paper. So your authority is paper and our authority is paper. Right? Our authority is the paper of Vedic literature and your authority is the newspaper. So what's the difference between you and us? Our authority is both paper. Yeah? So Prabhupada sometimes would argue on the basis of logic. And this is kind of like really common sense logic, just down, just taking it down to the roots. Right? Yeah, just paper. So, whatever may be, we're accepting this Srimad Bhagavatam as our authority. Why are we accepting Srimad Bhagavatam as authority? First of all, because the philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam is very logical and systematic and gives a coherent picture of how everything functions. But not only is there the book Bhagavat, along with the book Bhagavat is the person Bhagavat. Right? The self-realized soul who has based his life on Srimad Bhagavatam. So the person Bhagavat is the certification of the book Bhagavat. Without the person Bhagavat, we could have doubts about the book Bhagavat and say like, well, you know, Devakulya and Priyavrata and all those other personalities sounds like some myth here, right? Some folklore, some myth, you know. All the people of the world have their myths, right? Their stories, right? You go and I have many of such things on my computer, sacred texts, and then you can read the sacred texts of the Incas, right? So the other day I was reading some sacred text of the Incas, a little story, and there was a whole story how there was some girl from the heavens and some boy who, this girl came to earth and somehow or other he had something with her or at least they fell in love and all that. And the girl had some special mystic cloth and he got it and, you know, then something, then a whole entanglement, you know, typical mythological entanglement story, you know, like whatever, how the whole story went, doesn't really matter. There was a happy ending, you know. But they transformed into something else also, you know. In the end, they didn't stay human beings. They took other forms and this, that. And it was all like little myths and stories that kind of explain the origin of the earth and the origin of things, right? You'll find it with all the classical people of the world. And you find that Greek philosophers had their explanations of the universe. One of them had the idea that there was a big copper shell and that in this copper shell there were holes. Right? Had the idea there were holes and they were the stars. Right? That was the stars. There was a big fire outside, if I could say. There's a copper shell. And that's the universe, a big copper shell, and inside and there's holes, and outside of that there's a big fire. Now that was his idea. So because of the holes, you see the stars and so on in the sky. Well, it's an explanation. Right? It's certainly a creative explanation. Nice, you know. I guess in those days it was even something that, well, could be true. Nowadays, obviously, that is a bit too far out, right? But it's just as far out as Priyavrata drove with his chariot through the sky and replaced the sun and cut the continents to pieces with his wheels. That's also pretty far out. So these things we just accept. We accept them in one sense blindly, in the sense that we don't have any reasonable arguments, right, of how this is possible, other than that, well, why not, right? Why not? But if I tell you, you know, there were people once, a few hundred years ago, who were flying around here through Amsterdam just by flapping their arms, and they're getting off the ground, they're flying around, then you may say, like, well, you know, come on, you know, I mean, what's the proof of that? And then I would say, well, why not? Right? That would be the same same line of reasoning. So the why not line of reasoning is not really a very strong evidence. Right? So we're accepting it in one sense blindly. In another sense, we're not accepting it blindly. Because we're accepting it in the context of Bhagavatam. In Bhagavatam, we're not accepting blindly. Because we're accepting Bhagavatam on the strength of the person Bhagavat, on the strength of the cyclic succession, deep persons Bhagavat, and how it comes down. Just like in Bhagavad Gita, it is mentioned there as Devala, Asita, and these personalities are saying, they are saying that this is the bona fide process. They are testifying, they are certifying the authenticity of this process. Right? So it is the person Bhagavat that is authenticating Srimad Bhagavatam. Besides that, Srimad Bhagavatam is mentioned in other Vedic scriptures, but obviously Vedic scriptures cannot authenticate themselves. Right? One must first accept Vedic scripture, and then one can accept that as evidence. But if one doesn't accept Vedic scripture as evidence, then what is the evidence of the Srimad Bhagavatam? Then the only evidence of Srimad Bhagavatam is the person Bhagavat. The fact that someone who lived by the instructions of Srimad Bhagavatam became a fully perfect and self-realized person is the very proof that Srimad Bhagavatam is correct. And then, if Srimad Bhagavatam is correct, then Devakulya must have become the water that washed the feet of the Lord. And then Priyavrata must have cut these continents to pieces and so on. Then it all becomes authoritative. Therefore, Ado Guru Padasraya. First, one must take shelter of the spiritual master, because it is through the spiritual master that we are actually experiencing the living proof. He's the living proof. And at least the acharyas are the living proof. This is the system. This is essential. So we need very much the person Bhagavat. That's why people are always looking for a Mahabhagavat. Is there a Mahabhagavat? But there is a Mahabhagavat. There are many Mahabhagavats. Some people feel that if you don't have a living Mahabhagavat right now, right, then you're lost. You must have some Mahabhagavat somewhere who is in flesh and blood available on this planet, and you must connect with him, and if you don't, you're lost. But this is not what Srila Prabhupada taught, because Srila Prabhupada taught that he lives forever in his instructions, and the follower lives with him. It was printed right there on the beginning pages of Srimad Bhagavatam somewhere. Is it still printed in this edition? Only in the first canto? Or was it in every canto? I'm not sure. It used to be in other editions. There was a little page, dedication page, where they used to print in the earlier editions. He lives forever in his instructions, and the follower lives with him. And Prabhupada didn't put that just to decorate the Bhagavatam. Right? He didn't put it there just to put a nice little something that would make the book look respectable. It's a further essential point that we should understand. Prabhupada is also here today. And also here today for us to connect with. Not that that's enough, because that's not what Prabhupada said, and that's not what his books say. It's not that we are saying, yes, make your direct connection with Prabhupada. There's a group of devotees who feel, yes, Prabhupada is the principal connection, and therefore he is actually delivering us. Right? He is really the one who is doing it, and therefore it's that connection that counts, and therefore we can still make a connection with him, and posthumously we can also become his disciple. But that is not the philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam. nor is that the philosophy that Prabhupada taught. And they think that Prabhupada made some statement like that, and they are using some letters and twisting them, etc. So this is all incomplete understanding. This is the understanding of one who is a Kanista Adhikari. Because Kanista Adhikari has no realization. And therefore, a Kanista Adhikari thinks nobody has any realization. I don't have realization, so nobody else has any realization either. I have no experience of Krishna conscious inspiration, so nobody has any. Only Prabhupada. Right? That is Kanista Adhikari. A more advanced devotee who actually has practical realization of the presence of Krishna, of his relationship with Krishna, right? Of how Krishna is reciprocating, and who has practically experienced that Krishna is reciprocating with him, right? And who has actually experienced, who has become deeply attached to his service to Krishna, and who's ready to sacrifice everything for that. Such a devotee looks at that and is saying, yes, but, you know, are you not experiencing Krishna? Are you not having any direct mercy from Krishna then in your life? Nothing, you know? How can you say that no one has any realization? No one can offer anything? No one has any potency? But how is this? There are only Kanista Adhikaris and Prabhupada. Uh-huh. So that's a very artificial understanding of spiritual life. Rather, in spiritual life, there are many potent personalities who are surcharged with the energy of the Lord. Right? And it always carries forward. And naturally, they are all, the more they are faithful and dedicated to the Acharyas, the more they become empowered. That is the system. Evam parampara praptam imam rajasyo vidu. The system of parampara is there. And the more one takes that parampara to heart, the more potent we will become. So that is to be considered, and that is important. So we are receiving this transcendental knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam in parampara. And in that way, we can have full faith in it. That it works. That it's not just mythology, but that it works. Again, another group of devotees have jumped on an understanding of Bhagavatam called Adunikavat. And Adunikavat is a type of understanding. Adunik means contemporary, actually, the word. So it basically means that they say there is a historical aspect to Bhagavatam. And there is a transcendental, philosophical aspect to Bhagavatam. So they say certain things are just historical, mythological, and then there are transcendental instructions. So those who adhere to Adunikavat, they would say these kind of descriptions here that we're now getting about these personalities, that's all the mythological part of Bhagavatam. And then there's another part of Bhagavatam which is giving you the pure transcendental aspect. Right? But this is not accepted by Bhagavatam itself. Right? Bhagavatam does not establish this point about itself. Right? Bhagavatam rather is stating that it's the Amalam Puranam, Yat Vaishnavam Priyam, right? Which is most dear to the Vaishnavas. It is saying the spotless Purana. Right? There is no fault. Established as the fully transcendental scripture. So therefore, one must accept Bhagavatam as a whole as transcendental. And we see how Prabhupada did that, right? And was never doubting Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada was in a spirit of accepting Bhagavatam. It wasn't necessarily so that that he knew everything about everything. Right? That was not necessarily so that he knew every detail about every detail. That was not necessarily so. Sometimes there were details Prabhupada also didn't know, right, about a detail. But Prabhupada knew always the essence of things. Right? He always knew the essence and the importance of things. And Prabhupada had a full understanding of the hierarchy of knowledge, what was important and what was not important. And whatever Krishna wanted to reveal to him, Krishna revealed to him. So, that he also knew. So maybe he knew also many things. Like sometimes nowadays there's a lot of discussion about the model of the universe. And that's a very technical thing. Right? And Prabhupada also wanted that the devotees would study Vedic texts to come up more with the model of the universe. And in his final days, there was a lot of discussion about the model of the universe. Okay, now, so many years went by, and now devotees have written books about models of the universe. Right? But Prabhupada also made statements about the model of the universe. Prabhupada said that the planets, the position of the planets, etc., looked something like a chandelier, Prabhupada said. The universe looks something like a chandelier. Yeah? So, that was not that Prabhupada simply didn't know. Somehow or other, either he had direct insight or he had heard it from authoritative source. We will never know where he got that from, whether he heard it from authoritative source or whether he got that by some direct insight from Krishna. But Prabhupada had both these sources of knowledge. There's no doubt about it. Prabhupada also stated that directly. At least in regarding to knowing the plan of Krishna, how do you know what Krishna wants? Yes, Rameshwar said, the pure devotee knows it because the Lord reveals from within the heart. No, Prabhupada says, if I want to know what Krishna wants, I ask him. Right? So, like that, Prabhupada had that direct connection with Krishna. So whatever source... So Prabhupada was transcendental. And the understandings and the statements of Prabhupada were always transcendental. And as Prabhupada said, when he was reading these books, he said actually, oh Prabhupada, you're reading your own books. No, these are not my own books. These are Krishna's books. Krishna wrote these books. There is no doubt that Krishna actually... was very close to Prabhupada when he was writing his books and inspiring him and so on. So sometimes with our great intellect we are thinking, well, but this doesn't make sense and that doesn't seem to be so intelligent and this doesn't seem to be so deeply thought out and so on. I rather would see there are many other possibilities here, and if I really analyze it myself, then I would think that this might not be correct. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur addresses this very point in his book, Sri Chaitanya's Teachings, and there he is making this point by saying that sometimes the empiric philosopher is thinking that this acharya, he is just very conditioned, narrow-minded, and rigid in his understanding, and not at all reasonable. Yes. He is just sentimentally attached to some idea, but actually not reasonable. And it doesn't make sense, it says. But it says that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta explains, he said, but actually, he said, guru means heavy because he is never moved from his position in transcendental knowledge, and that in due course of time, it will become revealed and then it will make sense as one is purified. So one should never judge the acharya by his intelligence and think at one point that the Acharya may have missed something, that the Acharya may not have fully got something right, and that that maybe now one is just that person who's understood better. Then immediately one is over-intelligent. One is no longer intelligent, over-intelligent. At that point, and there are from time to time such over-intelligent things coming up, right, in the association of the Vaishnavas, and that's why I'm addressing the point. It's not a theoretical issue, which I'm bringing up. It's a realistic issue. It happens from time to time. So, therefore, we must beware. We use our intelligence to try and understand how Srila Prabhupada is right, and we are just dedicated to that. And if somehow or other we cannot figure that out, right, then we must say, well, okay, I'll put this on the shelf. I can't figure this out. I'm waiting until I get some more guidance in this issue. Then maybe I'll understand. In this way, one must remain very faithful. Very faithful. Yasya deva parabhaktir. This is the principle. That one must have great, great faith in both the spiritual master and the words of the spiritual master, and in Krishna. Then the imports of all Vedic literatures will be revealed. So, ultimately, Vedic literatures depend on revelation. They don't depend on intelligence. Through intelligence, one cannot actually understand the Vedic literature, but through revelation, by purity. So therefore, reading Srimad Bhagavatam is not an intellectual process. Although certainly it has been analyzed by Vaishnavas such as Jiva Goswami, who were highly intellectual, right, and who have in a very intellectual way analyzed Srimad Bhagavatam, but still beyond that there is revelation, where one depends on the Supreme Lord, who through the descending process gives us understanding. And this is how we are reading Srimad Bhagavatam and its aspects that seem to be almost mythological, and see it from a transcendental perspective. And we always treat Bhagavatam with full respect. Whatever is said in Srimad Bhagavatam, that is true. And Prabhupada acted like that, even if the whole world did not agree, did not care. The world is wrong. Bhagavatam is right. And in that spirit, even whether we understand it or not, Bhagavatam is right. And that is the principle in which we approach Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, so if there are any questions or comments, I'll try to answer them. Different universes, different Bhagavatams, different yugas, many pastimes are repeating itself. And they are different. There's a variety every time. Like in Bhagavatam, we find a reference to a white varaha and to a red varaha. So how is it that varaha is sometimes described white and sometimes red? Because he appeared in different yugas. So yes, such things are there. There may be differences in different universes. There may be differences in different yugas, because everything is happening on a cycle, and somehow or other it is repetitious, because the arrangements of the Lord and certain pastimes are repetitious because they deal with the particular mentalities and the conditioning of the living entity. And they are a particular remedy for purifying that mentality. So some things are also repetitious. Krishna and his demons, they appear again and again. Like there is a story how in one Purana, in one yuga, the Sringadev did not come out of the pillar. The Sringadev came running from outside the palace. and on the way killed many demons, and then ran into the palace and then ripped up Hiranyakasipu. So in that yuga, it was a little different. No pillar. So like that, there are these differences. Yes. Because the Vedic literature is so broad. Yeah. It's so incredibly broad. And it deals with such amazing time spans. You don't have anything that compares. You know, when we have something few hundred years old, wow. And from a few thousand years old, we have an inscription on a stone. Wow. Right? We have something, you know, an inscription on a stone. Wow. Somebody wrote something and it's 5,000 years old. We still have. Wow. Herodotus made a column, right? Wow. Yeah, it's all there. Wow. And like that, we can go on and on. We don't have any information, actually, a little bit. But the Vedic literature supplies us so much information about something that happened incredibly long ago. So, and then it happened, then we find out that it already happened once again before that. And again, and again, and again, and again. It's inconceivable. So when there's contradictions in Vedic literature, again, we accept, in one sense, we just accommodate that. Yeah, some contradictions there. Anyway, we have full faith in the Vedic literature because, you know, this is coming down in the cyclic succession. It is perfect, it's transcendental, coming from the Supreme Lord. And the person Bhagavat is here to certify, to testify that it's all a fact. Yeah. Like that. We buy it, you know, contradictions and all. And a contradiction is not a contradiction. It's just that we see it as a contradiction. It appears to be a contradiction. So there are no controversies in the scripture. There are no controversial points. There are no such things at all. They're all totally perfect. It's just we, from our conditioned perspective, things look controversial or contradictory. Any other question? Yeah, that's part of the Uttamadhikari coming down. Because Uttamadhikari is... Of course, there are different levels of Uttama Adhikari. They start to count Uttama Adhikari at the stage of Bhava, and it's the stage of Prem. So not every Uttama Adhikari, according to the definition, is necessarily a Parisat devotee of the Lord, one who is an Antaranga Bhakta, or one who is aware of his Siddhadeya and who is under the influence of the internal energy and actually... while he's here in the material world, already perceiving the spiritual reality. One counts already one who is in Bhava, right, as being Uttama Adhikari. That begins there. So there's also different levels of Uttama Adhikari. The Antaranga Bhakta, or the devotee that is under the internal energy fully, and who knows his spiritual identity, etc., and who can look into the spiritual world and who can exist in both of these identities at the same time. Such a devotee, well, you know, he can do all kinds of things, of course. I mean, he's like mystically empowered to a point where it's inconceivable. So if an Uttama Adhikari, you know, he may come down to see the world as not perfect, or to describe the world as not perfect. He doesn't actually change his vision. When the Uttama Adhikari comes down, he doesn't change his vision. He just presents himself on the second class platform. That's what it means, Uttama Adhikari coming down. He presents himself. And he acts within the context of a second-class person who makes distinction between favorable for the Lord and unfavorable for the Lord. Favorable for devotional service, unfavorable for devotional service. Demons and devotees. Like that. But he's not really. He's just for practical purpose acting like that. But actually, internally, he's still Uttama Adhikari. So even when he comes down, doesn't fully come down, actually. Internally, he's still up there. He's still Uttama Adhikari.
I think that if one preaches about very heavy things, that one must at the same time have the spiritual strength and the spiritual inspiration to be able to increase faith in the person. Because preaching means to increase someone's faith. If by our activity, somehow or other, in spreading Krishna consciousness, we are giving people the philosophy, but if we are not increasing their faith, then we're not preaching. Yeah? Then we're not preaching. I mean, I remember someone who used to, in Vrindavan, make a big thing about bold preaching. You know, I'm preaching very bold. Bold preaching, he said. It was very bold. But in his bold preaching, he would often point out faults in people's gurus. And he would say, if someone says that if someone thinks that the criticism that I'm giving applies to their guru, right? Then I would say, then my reply is, well, if the shoe fits. So, you know. So he said, yes. And someone say, I should not preach so bold, you know. But Prabhupada was preaching bold and said we should be bold preachers. So my response to him was, bold it is, but preaching it ain't. Right? Bold it is, boy, but preaching it ain't. Right? Because preaching means building faith. So you can destroy in preaching. Right? You can give fear in preaching. You can talk about hell and burning, and you can take people completely down there and give them the biggest nightmare of their life if you're there to catch them at the end, right? With love and bring them back. Right? Then it's okay. But if you don't have that power, and to just say, here's the fifth canto, you know. That's a bit much. But then again, you know, so when we're distributing books on the street and we're just throwing the fifth canto in someone's lap, then we do that with a little prayer. My dear Lord, my dear Krishna, here I'm just dropping a nuclear bomb in an innocent person's lap, right? I'm giving him the fifth canto. Please, somehow or other, let it land properly. Right, and let it not do any damage. So we're praying to Lord Chaitanya to somehow or other let it land, this transcendental knowledge. Yeah, when we distribute the fifth canto separate. Because what can we do? Sometimes we have a fifth canto left. You know, when we serve a Bhagavatam, we just distribute them left and right. There's a fifth canto left. What can we do? We have to distribute them also. So, but then it's understood that we hope that Lord Chaitanya makes up. So we don't make it our business, you know, to just tell everyone all the details about hell and you're going to hell and you're going to burn and, you know, you're so sinful, you know, and your mother is going to go to hell and your sister is going to burn and your father is a demon and, you know, your whole dynasty is just vampires, you know. You're just Frankenstein and on and on and on until someone is totally ready for a mental hospital or something. You know, that's not our aim. Right? So, I think we should be very careful about this heavy preaching. Right? Heavy preaching you can do if you can somehow or other increase someone's faith by giving something else also. Prabhupada could do. Yeah, in a moment. No one knows the qualities of Krishna in full. Everyone knows only a little bit of Krishna. No one can know the unlimited Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everyone knows only the tip of the iceberg, but that tip is so wonderful, that that's enough. What more do you want to know? Right? Just give me a little tip of the toe of the Lord, and then I'll be totally, that will be enough. Please place me as one of the atoms at your lotus feet, my Lord. That's good enough. Just an insignificant creature, a little, just there, near your mother of pearl lotus nails.
The book of Sarakutra, of course, the Vedic seems to explain
I see. Well, we see something, some ambiguous points that need to be answered. Namely, that he says that in the physical sense, right, the moon is closer than the sun, but in the sense on the Bhumandala plane, if we look at it from the projection on the Bhumandala, then the moon is actually further away than the sun. So he said, like, in the Vedic literature, when we're speaking about the moon being further away from the sun, that we're talking about a projection map. If you have within this room all kinds of balls, Christmas balls, hanging on strings of the ceiling, if you put a lamp under it, right, then you get reflections on the ceiling, and it gives a projection map, right? And all these balls then come in different positions on that map. But you've just put a three-dimensional thing onto a flat surface. So therefore, things change, right? The shadows and the angles from the light source and so on. So in projection maps, sometimes things look a lot different than they would look if you measure actually from the balls. If you start measuring the distance between the balls on the ceilings, they may not be the same as the distance that you're measuring between the balls hanging from the strings, you see? That's the problem. So this is the principle of the controversy, where he said that the Bhagavatam is giving a projection map. So when it is saying that the moon is further away than the sun, it is like measured on the projection map. But if you actually measure it on the physical plane from planet to planet, right, his point was, then the moon is closer than the sun. Well, hallelujah, brother. This is a huge statement. It's a very big statement, because Srila Prabhupada was quite strong on this point of the moon. Therefore, I feel that this has to be really... it cannot just be concluded so quickly, as this is our understanding, representing A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada's teachings and so on. I think on that point, senior Vaishnavas will have to have some further discussion. So this is like, I'm not at all minimizing the book at all. I think the book is very nice. I think there are many nice, interesting things. There's a lot of research went into it. It's very professionally presented. So it's a good book. But to just say, I don't see anything that is under discussion in the book is a bit, that's not a fact. Leaders in our society have seen many things and have written other books to express that, and I think some debate is appropriate. Yeah? It's a study. I don't think it's a personal study of a devotee who has a personal idea. I don't think it necessarily represents the final conclusion of ISKCON about the model of the universe. So I think the book is very nice and valuable as a preliminary study to coming to the final acceptable model that fits in what Srila Prabhupada said and what Srimad Bhagavatam says and so on. Now you just read that part, yeah.
Now you gave another explanation now. Because it's about the measuring from the human
body. Now anyway, I mean, like, you know, to enter into like the whole Vedic cosmology discussion right here and now, in detail,
That's not the way to do it, because if you want to do it, then you have to actually take the Bhagavatam and you just, you know, take drawings, and then you have to do a whole research thing. You cannot just off the top of your head, right, start a whole discussion on Vedic cosmology and really go anywhere. If we'd want to dig out, right, the matter, if we'd want to do that, then we'd have to do that with the facts and figures and so on. And well, then we would partake in the discussion, and there are many others who partake in the discussion. Yeah. So I think that and obviously Sadaputta is brilliant, has done a lot of study, so we appreciate it, what he has done. But at the same time, we may ask some questions, may we not? Huh? And this question we have to ask. What can we do? It's unavoidable. And there's a few others that are also, that other leaders have asked. So the book is very suitable as a study on Vedic cosmology of a particular individual who presents a point of view of the result of his studies, full of interesting information. But the book is not the final publication which gives the view of the Vedic model as ISKCON accepts it forever. And that's important to understand. Huh? So therefore we're not at all diminishing the book nor the writer, but we just want to preface, it is not yet the final authorized model of the universe of ISKCON. It is the individual study of a very qualified devotee who put a lot of time in it. And we appreciate it for that very much. And I've read it with great interest. I've learned many things. But few questions remain yet to be answered. But then again, you know, in the greater context, it doesn't matter so much. See? In the greater context, we don't really care. I mean, we need this Vedic model of the universe for convincing the world, right? For dealing with the hardcore academic world, which are the high priests of modern society. So in order to establish the supremacy of Gaudiya Vaishnavism in the world, we need this. Right? So for preaching, we need it. For ourselves, we don't need it. I'm not going to lose any sleep over the model of the universe. I don't wake up in the morning thinking, where is the moon? Jai Hare Krishna. At night, I never think about the moon, actually. Like once Jai Advaita Maharaj mentioned here, that the moon is made of green cheese, right? To your good self, which basically meant the same. The purport of that, I mean, I'll volunteer to explain what he meant. Basically, he meant to say, I don't give a fig to stay in the foodstuffs now. I don't care at all about the moon, right? Whether it's made of green cheese or whether it is anything, whatever the moon is, you know, it's the moon, right? Okay, moon ki jai, right? Let's go on to Krishna now, kind of thing. With all due respect to everyone, you know. So it's a specialist type of service to figure out the Vedic cosmology, and we need it for establishing the supremacy of the Gaudiya Sampradaya in the world. That's all. But for ourselves, you know, if we don't exactly know this whole thing, anyway, you know, it's not that you have to take another birth if you don't, if you can't make a drawing of the Vedic universe. Right? Okay, now the final test just before you enter the spiritual world. Please make a drawing of the Vedic universe. Oh no. My God, you know, jeez. Huh? Another birth.
Not like that. So it's not part of the conditions to enter into the spiritual sky. Excuse me. Others, he said 32. We know very well that it came from Dr. Urquhart, Professor Urquhart, who was Prabhupada's teacher in the Scottish Church College, and we know that that quote somehow or other slipped in, and that Prabhupada used it. So just as we sometimes are using contemporary scientific information, right? Prabhupada used contemporary scientific information, which we look at now and consider totally wrong, right? And so some people look at this, how could Prabhupada say this? Well, yes, so Prabhupada also sometimes used some information from other sources, and just see how dangerous it is. It stands there as a warning to us, just so watch out, you know, using too many material sources to illustrate your Vedic arguments. Just like they didn't go to the moon. You could, of course, study those videos, you know, and that give you all the information about the shadows are in the wrong way, and the footprints should have not been there, but there, and, you know, and this and that, you know, all the material arguments. But you might get caught in that, right? Because in 20 years' time, somebody might prove all these material arguments that now make so much sense wrong, and then you're caught. And then we have built our whole thing on those arguments. So better we just stick to the basic arguments, Srimad Bhagavatam. So if Prabhupada said something about women less intelligent and so on, based on what Professor Urquhart said, then that was just an illustration. But Prabhupada, when he was dealing with men, women, intelligence, and that topic, right, which we're not opening up now, by the way, the lid is on top. I'm not going to enter into that discussion, right? But no. Yeah, that's okay. But the lid is on the box. But the fact that women would be less intelligent, right? If Prabhupada said it at all, right? Then he did so on the strength of scriptures, and that's the essence of it all. And if he, on a few occasions, used Professor Urquhart's statement, you know, it's just not so important. The real reason why women are considered less intelligent has nothing to do with 64 ounce, 32 ounce, 34 ounce. Everybody knows. It has to do with another thing. First of all, there's a different definition of intelligence in the Vedic literature. It has nothing to do with putting square blocks in round holes and in being able to understand certain mathematics and so on. Right? It has nothing to do with all that. Right? It has everything to do with being able to act upon intelligence. And intelligence is classified as understanding transcendental instructions. And to not be dragged off by the senses and the emotions, etc., but to stay on the intelligent platform in action, right? And therefore women are prone to be less intelligent, because they sometimes are not able to stay on that intelligent platform, but rather become very emotional and by the senses. So now I've opened up the lid anyway, but not in a nasty way of like trying to establish male superiority and all that, you know. So I think Professor Urquhart's comment that Prabhupada echoed, we're making too much of it. But of course the world would love to make a big issue out of it. So at one point they said, life comes from matter, let's not print it anymore. There was a push to not prove that life comes from life. Sorry, life comes from life, not from matter. Life comes from life. Let's not print it anymore, because in there that statement is quoted. Yeah?
in that book. Yeah, also. So there was opposition to do a reprint run of Life Comes From Life, because there's this statement in it, and what are we going to do with this? There, you know, print it. Just print Life Comes From Life. But it will make us look like fools. I don't think so. Anybody who makes such an issue out of that exposes himself as a fool, because you cannot really reduce Prabhupada to someone who made just this one statement. Anyone who is a little bit intelligent will say, anyway, that was just a little, according to his time, you know, his little influence, just a slight little influence by one of his professors. Big deal. Yeah. I don't think that professors like Hopkins or other, you know, friends, Dimmock, other friends of and who appreciated Prabhupada, right, will become impressed by such a statement. Let it go. So I don't think it's an issue. We should. No, it's not a major issue. Minor issue. Maybe. Mosar, yeah. Leela. Just like in his own pastime, Krishna has his things, you know, he seems to die and so on. It's all Mosalya Leela, the bewildering pastimes to bewilder the atheists and give them what they want. Okay, yes, Krishna is dead. He was an ordinary being. Go now. You know, you can go home now, you won, and leave us alone. Yeah, so that's also there. Of course, any devotee would say, how can Krishna die from being shot in the heel? You don't die on the spot from being shot in your heel. You might die from a terrible infection due to it, you know, from gangrene, right, as they call it, you know, where the leg starts to rot, and then blood poisoning, and finally, you know, then you die. But that doesn't happen on the spot. There's no history of any man dying from being shot in the foot. So anyone with a little intelligence can immediately see through that. Musalya little thing, you know. But Krishna gives it to the ages. Just go and run with it. I died. You know. Yeah, you go. Yeah. Krishna, he got shot. He died. Okay, go. So in the same way, some small timer may think, oh, just see, Prabhupada was a narrow-minded person. He's, you know, totally misinformed, right? Just his whole philosophy was just based on misconceptions, and the very proof is that he made that statement that men 64 ounce, women 32 or 34 ounce. Just see, you know, how his whole view was totally narrow-minded, conditioned, bound by his term. Just see, exposed. Ho. Okay, take it, go home with it, and enjoy. Right? Be happy. Be happy with your discovery. No. We don't care. Yeah, I mean, it's not a mistake in the sense, it's not that Prabhupada made that mistake, but it's a risk. There's a risk when we are quoting from material sources. Sometimes we do so to build bridges. Right? See, If you come here with the Priyavrata riding in his chariot through the sky and cutting up the continents, etc., and you tell this to someone who's totally cold, who's never heard anything about Krishna consciousness, it may be a little difficult to swallow the first time. So maybe there's something else we can first present to that person. We do not necessarily in the first meeting have to put all that on table. So we're trying to build bridges. We're trying to present first aspects of Krishna consciousness which are easier to accept to him. Yeah? And we're trying to sometimes present Krishna consciousness in his language. So we're taking an aspect of Krishna consciousness which is closer to something he can accept, and then we're looking maybe for a worldly for some worldly support. Just like we can say, for example, there is a material world and there's also a spiritual world. And the material world is a reflection of the spiritual world, we can say. Right? And then we can say, for example, just like Plato believed this, we find in the cave, in the example of the cave of Plato, we find a similar idea, you know, of the world, that this world is only a reflection of an original world. Right? So he had a similar concept. So we can lean a little bit on Greek philosophy to build bridges. Right? We're building a bridge there. Now, the problem is, when you lean on Greek philosophy for bridges, someone may just use 50 arguments to cut Plato's philosophy to pieces, right? It's just like, you know, totally go karate on that thing with 50 arguments. And suddenly you find yourself sitting there in a seat defending Plato, right? Although we're not at all, you know, we're not Platonists, right? That's not our business, actually, to defend. Let whatever they want to do to Plato. But because we made that bridge and that comparison with Greek philosophy, with the idea that we would bring it a little closer to people and make it more acceptable and show that Krishna consciousness is not isolated and alone, and we gave an example from there, we may find ourselves sometimes in hot water doing so. That is the risk of building bridges. That's all. So it's not that it was a mistake, but building bridges. And then you may sometimes find yourself in hot water. But it is a necessary thing in preaching to build bridges. Okay, I'll stop now because it's breakfast time. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.